When Hillary Clinton ended her unsuccessful run for president in 2008, she talked about the cracks she and her supporters made in the highest glass ceiling. Our guest today took that phrase for the title of her book on women running for president on several earlier points in history. Ellen Fitzpatrick is the author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. The book profiles Victoria Woodhull, Margaret Chase Smith, and Shirley Chisholm and their efforts to mount White House campaigns going back nearly 150 years. Ellen Fitzpatrick is a professor at the University of New Hampshire. She's a return visitor to the Exchange. She joined us several years ago with her earlier book of letters that followed the JFK assassination, Letters to Jackie. Glad to have you back in the Exchange, Ellen.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. I wondered where the opening vignette was going. It's Hillary Clinton speaking to a crowd, and some hecklers stand up and yell, "Iron my shirt." Really? How did she react?
Well, she handled it pretty well. It was actually a prank that had been organized by a Boston radio station. She was giving some remarks to her supporters in 2008 during the New Hampshire presidential primary. And she was in a high school auditorium, and these guys had T-shirts on, and they had posters, and they began chanting, "Iron my shirt," to remind, I guess, the putative, presidential hopeful that of her domestic duties. So it was a moment in which she handled it quite adroitly. She pivoted back to her central message and said that. She laughed and she said, "Oh, the remnants of sexism alive and well." And she said that, you know, part of what she hoped to do was to break through this highest, hardest glass ceiling. And hence, you know, she took advantage of the moment and tried to turn it to her own ends.
Now that it appears that Hillary Clinton will be the nominee of the Democratic Party, are there times in this campaign you thought it would slip away from her?
Yes, I thought that it was a bit of a rocky start, I think, and she had a formidable challenge really from Senator Sanders in the primary, which I don't think many people expected that Sanders would get the kind of traction that he had. So, you know, he gave her a run for her money. I did think that she would prevail ultimately, but it turned out to be more contested than I think. Certainly she anticipated.
I know, Ellen, you're a historian and not a political scientist, but is there still a portion of the electorate that would not vote for a woman, no way, no how?
It appears that that's a very tiny number. Now, whether they will vote for this woman is, you know, the open question, but the polls at least indicate that well over 90% of Americans have no problem whatsoever with the idea of a woman president. And in fact, many Americans express enthusiasm about the idea of having a woman president. So the fact of the matter is we just don't know till people get into the voting booth. But all the indications are that it's not an obstacle, maybe an advantage, and certainly among women voters, Clinton is, enjoying a very favorable gender gap.
Well, it was a huge obstacle. People who wouldn't vote for a woman for president in 1872, which is the year that Victoria Woodhull set her sights on in running for the White House. What lit the fire under her?
Well, she was a remarkable figure who really thought that there might be a way in which a female presidential candidate could in some way rally the country around the cause of women's equality, which she strongly supported. Of course, women could not even vote in 1872. Her argument was that she couldn't vote, but she could be voted for. And so she made a valiant effort to try to present herself as a candidate that embodied a cause. That would be the advancement of women in national politics and in American society. She wasn't a single-issue candidate by any means. She was quite progressive on a range of other issues, but she had to mount a third-party challenge because neither of the two political parties had any interest in her as a candidate.
And as always, the most interesting quotes come from people who are responding to what the protagonist does. So when Victoria Woodhull said she was running, she got responses from the likes of Harriet Beecher Stowe.
I must
admit, my mouth kind of opened on this one.
Yes, Stowe really, really disliked Victoria Woodhull intensely, and her dislike only grew in time. But she, you know, she sort of said, you know, what sort of brazen tramp of a woman would run for the presidency? And she said that, you know, men were torn apart, and that what by journalists and in the public sphere, and that a woman could expect only worse, that she would be, you know, dragged through all the muck and mud and then dumped into a dirty pail of water like an old mop. So she said, you know, do we want someone who could survive this ordeal to be the leader of our country? And, you know, it was clearly a rhetorical question. She certainly was not a fan of Victoria Woodhull's.
Interesting, though, but it would be okay for a man to get dragged through all that stuff?
Well, I think she at least Stowe was sort of drawing on the prevailing stereotypes of the time period, and indeed the tradition that politics and national politics in particular was a male domain, and that women had a proper, respectable, virtuous woman wouldn't think of entering into it.
Was part of the point of this book and the reason that you stuck with the three figures here, Victoria Woodhull, Margaret Chase Smith, and Shirley Chisholm, that that these were people who ran at a time when it was not something, well, for example, as opposed to doing some work on Michelle Bachmann and Carly Fiorina et al.
Right. I wanted to really try to provide the long perspective of history to what is going on today. It seems as if all of our contemporary candidates, when women have surfaced in the late 20th or early 21st century, you know, they're sort of like we have the conversation all over again. Wow, you know, there's a woman running for president. That's different. But it wasn't really that different. There's a long prehistory to it. Over 200 women have sought the office over the course of the long period of American history. And it seemed valuable to me to look at that.
Which we will continue to do when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with Ellen Fitzpatrick, the author of The Highest Glass Ceiling. Back with Ellen and Women Running for President in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about women who ran for president long before Hillary Clinton. Victoria Woodhull, Margaret Chase Smith, and Shirley Chisholm are profiled in a book by historian Ellen Fitzpatrick called The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe some questions for the author, maybe some observations about women running for president through history. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So to focus in on Victoria Woodhull, who set her sights on the 1872 campaign for president, and I did say 1872, she would not be a conventional candidate even today. What were some of the things that made her quirky and even a pioneer in some ways? Well, pioneer, obviously, running for office.
Well, she was, first of all, of course, women couldn't vote in this time period, so she was someone who was seeking an office that she wouldn't even be able to vote for herself. In addition to that, Victoria Woodhull had a kind of a remarkable career. She had grown up in a very hard scrabble environment. Her father was kind of a grifter. Her mother had some serious mental problems. And Victoria became interested in spiritualism very early in her life. And she had a career as a spiritualist and a clairvoyant that brought her into the orbit of Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was interested in spiritualism, and he was quite taken with Victoria Woodhull and found her to be the source of remarkably prescient stock tips, and so he backed her to open with her sister the first brokerage firm on Wall Street. So talk about ties to Wall Street. Victoria Woodhull was a Wall Street broker, and she made a big fortune in stock trading and used that money really to mount this campaign, which she self-financed like Donald Trump, and established her own newspaper to promote her candidacy. She was quite radical in her views and attracted a lot of attention from the public, who were quite intrigued by her.
I can imagine that, and she was indeed unique in many ways, but in other ways very much a product of her time. I mean, she was how old when she got married, and to whom?
She was married off at the age of 15 by her parents to a physician who had been called in to treat her for a fever. He was a dapper, attractive young man, and she soon found out when she married him that he was spent most of his time in brothels. He was an opium addict and a very troublesome guy. She had two children with him when she was very, very small, the firstborn when she was 16, and a very traumatic labor and delivery that he, in a drunken state, presided over. She left him eventually and then took up with a Civil War veteran named Colonel Blood. There's a kind of Dickensian quality to the characters in the Victoria Woodhull story. Mm-hmm. And he was a very radical guy, a spiritualist himself, and they took their marriage off to they went off to New York City, and that's where she really became a famous national public figure.
Let's place Victoria Woodhull in the context of her time. I mean, where this is 7 years after the Civil War, after one term of the inept presidency of Ulysses S. Grant. I mean, what might have been the mood of the country such that she thought it might have been a moment ready for someone like her?
Well, that's the fascinating thing about Woodhull's candidacy, that it was during Reconstruction, and she emerges and becomes interested in politics and becomes a public figure in 1868 as Congress is debating the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution that will confer citizenship on African Americans the vote on African American men. And she... the suffrage movement at that moment was trying to take advantage of that debate to have women included under the terms of the 14th and 15th Amendment. And Woodhull gets very involved with this and becomes, in fact, the first woman to testify before a congressional committee. She is making the case that women, because they are citizens, are already enfranchised, she argued, under the terms of the 14th Amendment. She wanted Congress to issue a declaratory act saying women already can vote under the 14th and 15th Amendment. They declined to do so, but she becomes a national figure in the midst of that debate. So really, Reconstruction and the activities of the women's movement in the late 19th century come together to create this historical moment for her candidacy.
Ellen Fitzpatrick's book is called The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. So her testifying before a congressional committee, no woman had ever done that before.
No, and she attracted a great deal of attention. She was an extremely beautiful woman, young. And, you know, that also, it won't surprise you, attracted the attention of newsmen who really seemed to delight in following what was going on. And Woodhull said, you know, we live in unsettled times. Who could have imagined even, you know, a few years ago that African Americans who, you know, 4 million slaves had been emancipated, and now there were African Americans being elected to Congress. And so she said, you know, we live in unsettled times. And the response to her was quite similar, saying, you know, with pundits saying things like, gee, you know, this is possible, a woman president. Some said, surely, you know, the petticoat government she established couldn't be any worse than the Grant administration. So there was quite a bit of interest in her.
You know, it was 2 full years before the 1872 election that she announced her candidacy,
yes.
or as we'd call it today, late.
Yes, true.
What was there some element of timing that she chose then? And I'm curious about the initial reaction, like some of the paper headlines.
Yeah, her announcement of her candidacy was really connected to these activities that she had been involved in with leading suffragists trying to move. They were attempting to get a 16th Amendment to the Constitution passed that would enfranchise women. And she's interested, instead of a 16th Amendment, in pivoting around this question of having the Congress do something different. And so it's really in that context that she announces her bid for president. She had a really interesting insight, which is that she thought that a candidate who embodied a cause might be able to unite the country better than a principle. That is, people might be able to get their heads around an actual candidate, a presidential candidate, more than you could unite people around, you know, a sort of philosophical position or a cause. So that's really what got her going. But it was very unusual in that time period for somebody to self-promote in the way that Woodhull did. But she was shrewd. She was, in some sense, a very modern presidential candidate. She made herself more important, really, than the party. And in the 19th century, of course, the parties had a tremendous amount of power, and the candidate was supposed to stand aside at a dignified remove and not promote himself. Well, that was hardly Victoria Woodhull.
Truly, that, you know, that's right. I'd forgotten about that part of things where candidates tended to stay on their front porches throughout the campaign and let other people campaign for them. So is there any indication that she wasn't entirely serious about the White House thing and really just wanted to draw attention to women's suffrage?
I think initially that was her goal. But as she got into it, she became quite, interested in, she was a woman like I think I would argue most presidential candidates historically. She had a very healthy self-regard. And, I think that she thought, hey, why not, you know? And she started a newspaper to promote her own candidacy. It was an era in which the newspapers were frankly partisan, and so she realized she would need her own newspaper to rally people around her cause. So I don't think it was entirely quixotic. She really, I think, on some level believed that she could do it in the face of, you know, all the ample evidence to the contrary.
And it's such an American story in the sense that it's about somebody gaining celebrity and then getting knocked down by it. So what did happen to Victoria Woodhull?
Well, Victoria Woodhull really ran into a buzzsaw when her mother, who really was not a very stable person, went down to the local police station in New York City and reported that she believed that her son-in-law, Victoria Woodhull's husband, was trying to kill her. Well, the police didn't, I don't think, believed it. It wasn't true, but they began an investigation. And in the course of that, they uncovered the fact that Victoria Woodhull was living not only with her current husband, Colonel Blood, but they had taken in her former husband, Canning Woodhull, who was now really dying of his drug addiction. Woodhull later said that she felt that it was one of the more humane things that she had done in her life. But what happened was a huge scandal was ignited in Victorian America. The idea of a woman living with two men, a former husband and a current husband, was just, salacious. And that she was portrayed as a woman with no moral virtue, and terribly bad publicity, and she was knocked down by that. She lashed out in response, it won't surprise you, and accused the leading Protestant minister of her time of having had an ongoing affair with one of his parishioners, and she was saying, this is the double standard that men can do these things, but women are held to a different standard. And she accused him of this in the pages of her weekly and was arrested on an obscenity charge because the newspaper was circulated by mail. On election day, she was in prison.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds almost like
there are those who want to see Hillary Clinton in prison on election day as
right,
well.
Yeah.
But so there's a funny kind of forerunner story here. But it was really this sex scandal and her troubles in her family that really brought her down. Not that I think she would have been otherwise successful. Clearly, she wouldn't have been. But.
Sure. And if people are forgetting the history, in 1872, Ulysses S. Grant, as bad as he was, won a second term. And and continued the wreckage. We're talking to Ellen Fitzpatrick, the historian from the University of New Hampshire here on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is called The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your thoughts about other women who you think should have run for president, maybe. Some thoughts on that vein, or women who have run for president who you thought weren't taken seriously enough. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So 90-odd years after Victoria Woodhull, we had Margaret Chase Smith thinking about the 1964 presidential election. What's the quick sketch on her?
Well, she was a great woman, a Republican who was the first woman to be elected to the House and to the Senate. And she had a remarkable political career. She finished out her husband's term. He died in office. He was a congressman from Maine, and in 1940 she comes into the Congress, and from then on in she remained in the Congress until 1972, when she was defeated. In 64 she was considered among the most admired women in the world on the Gallup poll, asking Americans. She was up there with Queen Elizabeth and Jacqueline Kennedy. And so in 64, in the fall of 63, she was widely being discussed as a possible presidential candidate. President Kennedy was asked about her in his last press conference before his trip to Dallas, and he said he wouldn't look forward to running against her. She was a formidable political figure. So, however, the minute she announced she was running in 1964, all of this admiration somehow turned out into incredibly deep skepticism that could this menopausal woman, 67 years old, really be president of the United States? And the doubts were articulated by pundits, political columnists in the newspapers, and it was really amazing to see the resistance to the idea.
All right, so that was one of the questions. Here we are 40 years after women could vote, which is
yes.
Very unlike the situation Victoria Woodhull faced 50 years essentially before women could vote. And yet still, it was considered a very oddball idea for a woman to run for president even then.
Yes, and in fact, you know, if you look at the sort of coverage of Margaret Chase Smith in 1964, I would argue there was more sexism in the newspaper coverage of Margaret Chase Smith in 1964 than there was of Victoria Woodhull in 1872. I mean, the things that they said about Margaret Chase Smith, who clearly was qualified and had, you know, a tremendous record. She served on the Senate Armed Services Committee. She, you know, was quite well-regarded, had long experience, and you know, had quite a formidable, as Kennedy pointed out, political record, but she was dismissed as, you know, was she out of her mind to even think this was a possibility?
Well, so she was in Congress, was not a shrinking violet, apparently. I mean, how different was her approach to her work there than other women who had been in Congress then or previously?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about her is that she came into Congress under something that used to be called the widow's mandate. That is, when a man died in office, oftentimes the political parties would appoint their wife or daughter or nominate their wife or daughter as a successor just to fill out the term. They were seen as placeholders because the assumption was they would have no political ambitions of their own, and then the parties had time to select an appropriate male successor, and they would get out of the way and go on to elect a male. Well, this is how Margaret Chase Smith came in. Her husband was a congressman from Maine. He died in office. He urged his constituents to put his wife in his place. They did so. But then she had political ambition, and she began running on her own. And the main Republican Party elders weren't entirely behind this idea. In fact, they fought her, but she prevailed. And she won election after election in Maine, and she was fiercely independent. One of her colleagues in the Congress once said about her Republican colleagues, if she votes with us, it's a coincidence. They just had no idea where she was going to come down on any political issue. And if she agreed with the Republican Party, she voted with them. If she didn't, she didn't. She was a great friend of Lyndon Johnson's, a big supporter of many of the great society measures. So she was a moderate Republican from New England, kind of a dying breed, mm-hmm. and, you know, really very, very highly regarded and somewhat feared, I would say.
The way you write about her, Ellen, she sounds like she might have been the cleanest member of Congress ever, certainly in her handling of money.
Yes, she really was. She had some very powerful backers, but she refused to take campaign donations. And going through her papers at her archive up in Skowhegan, Maine, as I was reading through these, I would find letter after letter, carbon copy of a letter, returning a $1 donation to her campaign, saying that she did not accept campaign contributions. Well, that was admirable, but in 1964, it was no way to run a national presidential primary race. You know, by that time, television had become critical and millions of dollars were now required to be competitive.
We'll talk about what did happen with Margaret Chase Smith on her way to the race for the presidency in 1964. Margaret Chase Smith, one of three people profiled in Ellen Fitzpatrick's book, The Highest Glass Ceiling. We'll come back and talk more with Ellen about women running for the White House and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. Back on The Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the historian Ellen Fitzpatrick, a professor at the University of New Hampshire. She has written a book about women running for the White House called The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency, in which Ellen profiles Victoria Woodhull in 1872, Margaret Chase Smith in 1964, and Shirley Chisholm just 8 years later in 1972. Lots of interesting tidbits about each of the three here in the book. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we'd just to back up a little bit from 1964 on Margaret Chase Smith, we'd mentioned that she got into the House via the so-called widow's mandate when her husband died in office, but then she decided to run for the full term, got it, won a Senate seat in 1948 with pretty much nickels and dimes here and there. She was called the new sweetheart of Capitol Hill in some quarters, but you say she cut the honeymoon short after her election. How'd she do that?
Well, she very quickly, proved her independence from the Republican Party, and probably I think that she, for one thing, she was quite supportive of women's issues. She introduced time and again the Equal Rights Amendment. She was a strong supporter of it. And in 1950, she had a big moment when she stood up to Senator Joseph McCarthy from Wisconsin. She was, McCarthy, of course, famously, and early in 1950, had claimed that the federal government was overrun with communists. And she listened to all of this and followed it. And by June of 1950, she gave a speech before her colleagues in the Senate condemning his tactics of smearing citizens and what she felt was providing no real credible evidence of the claims that he was making and the investigations that he was pursuing. She was tremendously courageous in doing so.
She was one of the few in the sense that, for all the times that McCarthy stood up and said, I have in my hand a piece of paper with the names of, whatever it was, and she said, show me the paper.
Yes, exactly. And he was furious at her, and the coverage was really quite remarkable. I mean, she had trouble getting anybody to sign on with her. Eventually, I think she had six other senators who agreed to sign her Declaration of Conscience, in which she really said to her colleagues in the Republican Party, look, we don't want to gain power by riding the four horses of calumny, and talking about smearing candidates and so forth. And she was just tremendously courageous in doing this. And McCarthy, of course, was furious at her, referred to her as Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the other men that had signed on with her being the dwarfs. But you know, she stood him down, and it was the really the political speech of her lifetime that she gave then in June of 1950.
So here she is, a national figure in June of 1950. Why did she not consider running for president in 1952?
I think that she, at that point, was really working her way up and was fairly new to the Senate. But by 1964, in the fall of 63, in the summer of 63, she was really being discussed openly as a possible candidate for president. And she, when asked about it later on, why did you do it? And she said it was the next logical step. You know, she had served through the whole decade of the 1950s with honor and into the early 60s and late 40s, had a wealth of experience. She was very hawkish in American foreign policy and had gotten quite a bit of attention there. She was opposed to Kennedy's nuclear test ban treaty, for example. Didn't make him very happy. But she... you know, she was very popular in her home state and really, you know, quite well known nationally. So she had a lot going for her, in theory.
In theory. I wonder if part of the reason that her name came up is because, you know, whoever runs against the president is running for reelection faces, the power of the incumbency.
Yes.
And I wonder if some larger figures in the Republican Party were not willing to step forward at that point. I mean, we did end up with Goldwater as the nominee running against Lyndon Johnson.
Yes. Well, and she actually, you know, there was the thing to remember about this is in as late as 1964, almost half of Americans, when they were polled and asked, would you vote for a woman for president if she was nominated by your party and was qualified in all other respects? Almost half of the Americans who were polled said no, they wouldn't. So, you know, from the point of view of the political elites in the major political parties, they thought, you know, we're not going to waste our time and energy on nominating a woman. And certainly it was a hard sell to put money on such a candidate, and it was very hard to attract donors. And so the financing became impossible as well.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, that ended up very much doing her in. So 8 years after this, in 1972, this is a lot like modern campaigns, I think, in the sense that you got a big flock of candidates showing up in the opposite party after the first term of a president of mixed success, in this case Nixon. What kinds of responses did Shirley Chisholm get then when she put her name in contention for 1972?
Shirley was really very determined, and she attempted to put together a coalition that was really quite modern in some ways. She was very much against the war in Vietnam. You could give her a stump speech today, and it would be completely relevant, amazingly, at least, and appealing at least to some. She was very concerned about economic inequality. She was very concerned about the plight that African Americans in inner cities were facing. She was worried about poverty, the existence of poverty in the United States, and the way in which people were falling below the safety net. So, you know, she was a very, very much a feminist, very interested in women's issues. And she attracted a lot of young people to her campaign, college students. There were a number of women who were involved in the women's movement, of course, very interested, African Americans. And she traveled around the country and competed in some primaries attempting to rally support for the causes that she believed in and to put together a kind of coalition of the have-nots. It was also the first election in which their 18-year-olds were going to be allowed to vote. So that was an unknown factor that she hoped to galvanize that constituency as well.
Let's go back in time just a little bit. Shirley Chisholm from Brooklyn representing, and actually from Bedford-Stuyvesant, which all New Yorkers know as Bed-Stuy and not one of the nicer parts of the city, or at least back then. Tell us a bit about her upbringing and the pathway to Congress.
Well, Shirley had grown up in Brooklyn, and her parents had sent her when she was a very young girl back to the West Indies to live with her grandmother. This was during the Depression. She returned to Brooklyn and then went to high school there and went on to Brooklyn College. And when she was at Brooklyn College, she became very interested in politics, and she started going to the meetings of the local district Democratic Club, which was dominated by an Irish political machine and a boss. And she was outraged at the way in which the boss and his minions, held on to power and did so little for the people in the district. As it became increasingly, as demographic change came and it became increasingly African American, eventually she was part of a vanguard that challenged that old Irish political machine and succeeded in overthrowing it. And then she was elected to the New York Assembly, and then from there in 1968 ran for Congress and became the first African-American woman elected to Congress.
And reelected in 1970. So what convinced her to run for president in 72?
Well, she had felt that, again, one of the things that happened after the disastrous Democratic convention in 1968 were some significant changes to the rules of the Democratic Party that mandated greater representation of both women and minorities in state delegations. And so I think she saw the opportunity to, first of all, advance the issues that were important to her, but also to sort of try to break through this boundary that seemed to be in place for women in national politics. And she felt that if she could, it was going to take her and other people like her challenging it by really getting out there campaigning and saying, I'm worthy of this office. I'm as good as the men that are running. Take a look at me. And that's what she proceeded to do.
You draw some interesting parallels in the book, Ellen, between the campaigns of Shirley Chisholm and George Wallace, of all people. And why the parallels? And he actually praised her at some point?
He did praise her. And when he was shot in 1972 in the course of that presidential primary race, she actually went to visit him in the hospital, which outraged some of her constituents. You know, how could you be going to see this guy? He's a racist. He's a former segregationist. Not entirely clear how well he had recanted. And she said, look, we live in a society that should not tolerate this kind of violence. And, you know, that she felt compassion for him. But he considered her to be a straight shooter. He basically said that unlike other Democratic candidates, she said what she meant. And she did. She was extremely outspoken. In fact, in the California primary, the Nixon administration, it later came to light during Watergate, attempted to pull a dirty trick on her and circulated some scurrilous gossip about her, claiming that she had been put into a mental institution in the 1950s and that she was unstable and so forth. She was no threat to Richard Nixon, but she was a vociferous critic of the Nixon administration, and they didn't like her much.
There are some interesting parallels I find here with Margaret Chase Smith, among things the small dollar congressional campaigns that both of them seem to run. And in both cases, it seems like they did not translate into presidential campaigns. How successful was Shirley Chisholm in the primaries?
Well, Shirley Chisholm actually got more delegates than any female presidential candidate before Hillary Clinton in 2008. She didn't do terribly well, but like Margaret Chase Smith, she had her name placed in nomination, and she did amass a number of delegates and got a tremendous amount of attention throughout that campaign. She was indeed a challenger, and so she was no threat really to McGovern in the end. But she certainly made her presence known, and really not until 2008, when Clinton ran, has any woman overcome the obstacles that were put in the place of all of her predecessors: the money, the national profile, the support of party elites, the public recognition, the vote-getting capacities. Amazingly, these have been turned into sources of criticism for Clinton in this campaign this year.
So let's take the apparatus that exists today and place either Shirley Chisholm or Margaret Chase Smith into those. I mean, do you think either one of them might have been a whole lot more successful starting at the point where Hillary Clinton was able to start?
Absolutely. I think there would be a number of Republicans today that would love to see Margaret Chase Smith, you know, revived and, you know, placed in the setting today. She was, even in her time, a rare figure, a very accomplished person. And I think the prejudices that existed then, many of them have been overcome in our own time. And, you know, her stance as somebody who was very, you know, again, very strong on national defense. She was a moderate Republican, had a great deal of support and national recognition. I think that the Republican Party would be glad to see a Margaret Chase Smith emerge today.
It'll be curious to see who emerges from the Senate race going on in your state, because I know there's a big dust up with Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan running.
Yes, yep, that's right. And you know, the strides that women have made in national politics are really extraordinary. That's why the obstacles in the face of the presidency are so notable.
The book is called The Highest Glass Ceiling: Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen Fitzpatrick wrote it, and join us once again in the exchange. Ellen, good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Jeffrey.